This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. And if you say, like, the Wizard of Oz, right, most people conjure up images of Dorothy skipping happily along with her little dog, making new friends with her adventures. But you know, it wasn't all rainbows and sunshine on that yellow brick road.
And as for you, my fine lady, it's true, I can't attend you here and now as I'd like. But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Your little dog, too. The Wicked Witch, Wizard of Oz, just one of many films that terrorized you as a child, right? Here today to talk about those movies that traumatized us all, Marcia Gordon, film professor, professor of film studies at North Carolina State University, Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back to both of you. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
This is going to be fun. Terrifying movies. And it turns out this was really, I mean, people all chimed in on this, right? We've all got this film.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of unbelievable, the listener response that we got to this particular idea. Everyone who goes to the movies has either a film or a moment or multiple films and multiple moments that really terrify them and often, you know, has stuck with them, you know, over the course of 10, 20, 30 years.
And I loved it as a question to ask people that I knew very well that we had not discussed this. For example, I was talking to my mother about how my father was terrorized by King Kong, which he saw when he was 8 years old. And of course, there had never been a movie like that before. And my mother said, well, she must have been a little older when she saw it, but she said, I knew that King Kong wasn't real, but I think your father believed that it was for real.
So that's it. It turns up all these stories, things, and people are kind of waiting to be asked, too. That was the other thing. It's like,
yes.
Hey, when are you going to ask me? Ask me about my favorite one.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, yeah, this has been a fun topic.
So terror for me I love horror movies. So almost nothing scared me after the age of seven. But at the age of seven, at Jimmy McMahon's birthday party, we all pile into the – we thought we were just going to have cake and ice cream. No, his parents pile us all into a car. We go to a movie theater. This is the reason you went to Jimmy McMahon's house, by the way, because everything went there. No way my parents would let me see 13 ghosts, right? But if you go to Jimmy's house, it's very likely that they're actually in his house. And if they're not, you go see the movie. I'm 7 years old, and it was in 3D. Check this out.
Now, brace yourself as we take you across the threshold of our haunted mansion. Where there's a ghost for everyone in the family. Father, mother, sister, brother. You'll be scared stiff too when you see what they see. 13 ghosts materializing in ectoplasmic color through the magic of Illusiono, the ghost viewer.
Illusiono. That was the thing that scared me. If it hadn't been for Illusiono, I couldn't do it. It was really there were like these 13 ghosts. They're all haunting this house. The chef would throw the butcher knife, come right at you.
So it was the 3D that scared you.
It was 3D, but also they were really kind of terrifying figures, and you wouldn't see them, and then you'd see their manifestations, and then you put the glasses on, and there they were.
So it was like a haunted house, but it was in cinematic form. Because, you know, this is William Castle film, and William Castle is one of the interesting kind of B-movie gimmick directors of the 1950s, 1960s, and he did a film called The Tingler in the late 50s with Vincent Price, and the gimmick was that, you know, there would be a seat or two in the audience that they would put something in that would vibrate at the end, and then people would scream in the audience. So he liked to do these kinds of tricks, and so I guess the 3D trick worked with you.
Worked with me.
And in fact, when I was asking my friend, someone said that her sister was in fact so terrified by the Tingler. But maybe it was because the Tingler emerges when Vincent Price does like a little, you know, kitchen autopsy on a woman who has died of fright and drags it out of her spine.
And this stuff hadn't been kitsch yet, right? I mean, the idea of the haunted house and the Tingler and all these things, they were actually kind of new when I was seven. And the thing for me was I could not sleep with the lights off for years and years and years. I mean, years and years and years. I had to have a light on. It's like my honeymoon. I said, honey, are you going to turn the light off? Well, or something. Tell me about 13 ghosts. Okay, so we talked. We opened up with The Wizard of Oz, Laura, but the flying monkeys, it's a big deal for people.
Yes, exactly. Many, many people brought up the flying monkeys. And, of course, it's partly because The Wizard of Oz used to be an event that you sat in front of the TV annually with your family. You saw it once a year. So you had an entire year to anticipate the fear once more of the flying monkeys.
Take your army to the haunted forest and bring me that girl and her dog. Do what you like with the others, but I want her alive and unharmed. They'll That'll give you no trouble, I promise you that. I've sent a little insect on ahead to take the fight out of them. Take special care of those ruby slippers. I want those most of all. Now fly! Fly!
Bit of good filmmaking there, too. I mean, that's a scary-looking scene. The background, the darkness, right?
Well, and that the monkeys are not quite right. I mean, regular monkeys are kind of scary, but these deformed monkeys are even more scary.
And the music and Margaret Hamilton's voice. I mean, it's just a conspiracy of all of these factors. But I remember very vividly closing my eyes and asking my parents, tell me when the monkeys are gone. I didn't want to even see them. And I think this is almost a universal horror. And I think one of the interesting things about that is that is the part of the movie that terrified me in that way. When you think about the story of The Wizard of Oz, and this is a film that I teach sometimes, it's really a pretty terrifying story when you think about the fact that it's about, you know, this Dust Bowl, Kansas, depressing world. And the end of it is nothing changes and you go back to your life and there's no place like home, but somebody's probably going to kill your little dog and, you know, you are living in a Dust Bowl, Kansas farm. So the whole story is actually pretty depressing, but that particular...
Your house has been destroyed by a tornado.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, but, and The Return of Oz, less well known, but also a scary movie for a lot of people.
Yeah. So The Return of Oz is one of those films that you go, whose idea was this to make a kids movie about this? Dorothy has returned from Oz. Nobody believes her because she's got these fantastic stories about, what happened to her in this faraway place. And it gets to the point that, you know, her aunt and uncle say, you know what, we need to find Dorothy. We need to find Dorothy some help. Oh, wow. Look at this advertisement for this place where we can take Dorothy that will solve all of her problems.
Would you like to go for a ride, Dorothy? Lie down.
I'd like to sit up if I may.
What did your aunt tell you?
To do what you told me, Miss Wilson.
Then lie down.
Why do you have to tie me down?
So that you don't fall off.
I came all the way from the farm in the buggy and didn't fall off. Did I hear somebody scream over there?
No.
Hello, Dorothy. How are you?
I wish I wasn't tied down.
Nothing to worry about.
What are those?
Oh... When you're ready, we'll just put them over your ears, and pretty soon they'll draw all those unpleasant dreams out of your head.
Yeah, so this is preparing Dorothy for electroshock therapy because somebody has to help her with this little delusional problem. And so the good news is that there's an electric storm that saves her from electroshock therapy. But I was just watching this film, and I thought, if I had seen this as a kid, I did not. This came out in the 80s. Mercifully, this escaped my viewing. But I would have been mortified because it's, you know, nobody believes you. You're, you know, sent off to this scary place by yourself. You're going to be given electroshock therapy. And then even worse in this case, she ends up back in Oz. And Oz has been, like, destroyed. Yellow Brick Road crumbled. There's these creatures called the Wheelers. And a number of listeners talked about how terrifying the Wheelers were. I mean, they're ridiculous now. But as a kid, you would think they were horrifying. And there's a talking chicken making jokes. And it's just kind of this incredibly nightmarish world. And it's hard to believe that this was deemed, you know, children's.
Well, I was going to ask you, because I didn't see it. Was it presented as a kid's film, or was it kind of an arch? No,
it was absolutely presented as a children's film. Interestingly enough, it was directed by Walter Murch, who is one of the great Hollywood sound designers and editors who worked on Apocalypse Now. And this is might be the only film that he directed. And I don't know. I would be very interesting to read the studio memos, them trying to figure out what the market is for this film.
Well, I'm assuming that it was because L. Frank Baum wrote so many Oz books.
Right.
And everyone was like, this is a gold mine. You know, we have to get some of these other characters out of these books.
And they did. They own the rights. And, you know, I have read that was one of the reasons they did this. If you own the rights to that franchise, well, why not make another version
of
it?
Go do it. Well, another children's film that didn't always work out so well for kids was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
My name is Alex McInerney. I live in Carrboro and I work in Siler City. And the movie that terrorized me the most as a kid was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And the reason why it terrorized me was throughout the movie, Gene Wilder's manic rendition of Wonka had been rubbing me the wrong way. But then the acid boat trip was what really did me in. Wilder sadistically among the neon lights, the Oompa Loompas rowing frantically like they're extras from Ben-Hur, the chocolate river glowing red like blood, and then suddenly that brief flash of the chicken getting decapitated was kind of the final straw.
Is the grizzly reaper mowing? Yes! The danger must be growing, for the rowers keep on rowing, and they're certainly not showing any signs that they are slowing!
Welcome, kiddies.
Why did Gene Wilder not get an Oscar for this?
I don't understand. Honestly, it is such a phenomenal performance. And we're sitting here kind of laughing during it because it's so completely over the top. But that scene is really pretty scary. It's this kind of heavily edited montage sequence of all of these scary things with these people held captive on this boat. And, you know, one of the listeners said that it took them 20 years to come back to finally watch this film again. And so, you know, even these films that have these different layers of, like, there's comedic and whimsical moments can also have these scenes that just strike terror into our imaginations.
I could never understand why people remembered this fondly, you know, as something that was a comforting memory of their childhood. Because Roald Dahl, if you read his books, to my daughter as I did, he apparently did not like children very much because they're all really – James and the Giant Peach, Matilda, all of these things are really disturbing.
Well, and if you know about his life, he was not liked much as a child by his parents. And so that at all – well, we'll talk more about that, especially a few more kids' films and other films that terrorized you with Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State, Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. More at the movies when we return to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking today about those movies that gave you nightmares as a kid, and maybe you're still having those nightmares. Who knows? I'm joined, as I am each month, by Marcia Gordon, a professor of film studies at North Carolina State University, and Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. And just before the break, you know, we're talking about movies that were presented as kids' films that turned out to be kind of the highest number in, if there's a genre. It's like kids' films were the most traumatizing, and Disney gets the big award, and I guess Bambi would maybe be number one.
There is no trauma like a Disney trauma. And from film to film, people mentioned, of course, Bambi, which colors are feeling about not just this particular movie, but about all deer in general, even the ones eating your garden.
Bambi, come here.
Look. New spring grass.
Bambi, quick. The thicket.
That was worse on the radio than it was on
the screen. Well, you know, it reminds you of how powerful some of the music is and how much what you don't see. I mean, even if we were watching that scene, it's not like you actually see Bambi's mother shot. You know,
although you may remember that you saw her shot.
You may. But, you know, so many Disney films have these moments of either, you know, loss in terms of death or incredible trauma and separation. I'm thinking about Dumbo, which that scene where Dumbo's mother is trying to protect him from these people who are picking on him and pulling his ears and being really mean to him. And she just kind of lightly spanks one of the kids. And all of a sudden, everyone descends on her, starts whipping her, and sticks her in this, you know, little cage and labels her as a mad elephant. And she's sitting in there weeping in little Dumbo all alone. And, I mean, these are really scary things. So these films dealt with real issues of loss and separation and trauma. And, you know, we think of them as these animated children's films as if that, you know, suggests something about their, you know, lack of seriousness, but they are very serious.
No, but
films.
They are cartoons, and that does have an effect on. Does it double the fear? In other words, it does because we're disarmed by the form. Are we actually setting ourselves up for greater trauma?
I think if you're in the moment with a film like this, it doesn't matter that it's a cartoon elephant with big ears. I think that it really speaks very deeply to your fears.
Well, except that, you know, also the anthropomorphizing part, the fact that these are animals playing the role of mother and child. I mean, if these were about people, it would be a little bit different, right? If it was, you know, a person being shot or a child being, you know, beaten at the circus or whatever, you know, there's also something about projecting that onto an animal that makes it somehow okay for people to show it to their children in addition to it being animated.
So we wouldn't even do it if we couldn't animate it and put
right.
it in the form of an animal.
Exactly.
There's no way you'd bring your kids to this.
Right.
Sometimes it's because it's scary, but sad and painful is kind of the theme now. Some of the themes that come up.
Yeah.
It's not the gore, it's the theme, and Old Yeller, I guess, fits the bill.
Yeah, I mean, and so this is another instance of, you know, projecting these things onto an animal, but this is, of course, the relationship between a young boy who ends up kind of adopting this, you know, old yellow dog and getting this incredible attachment to him. At first, you know, doesn't really want anything to do with him, and then this dog does all these heroic things, including kind of saving them from a wolf who happens to have a little communicable disease.
No, Mama. There's no hope for him now, Travis. He's suffering. You know we've got to do it.
I know, Mama. He was my dog. I'll do it.
Ooh, talk about a life lesson there for Travis, right? I mean, having to shoot his own rabid dog as a merciful act. And
well,
I mean,
this is also a Disney movie,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So it's Disney is taking it one step farther into real life.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those things that the life lesson from this film is, you know, that it's okay to have these attachments. Loss is part of life. And at the end, you know, there's a puppy that is, well, young Yeller. And, you know, Travis.
It's not the same, though.
It's not the same, although he does take after his daddy. So that's, you know, the lesson is that life goes on. So these films are, in fact, kind of demonstrating, I think, important ideas that people have to have as coping mechanisms to live
with
life.
Well, and we've known that about fairy tales that they've been told for a long, long time. And they're horrifying. They're terrible stories
right.
about
and there
loss
was,
and grief.
There was one fairy tale I could never bring myself to read to my daughter was Hansel and Gretel, because the idea of your parents abandoning you in the forest was so upsetting to me. And I recently discussed this with her, and she said, oh, that didn't bother her. But Little Red Riding Hood, you think it's your grandma and it's a wolf?
That's right. How could you let me into the place
so,
like
so
this?
So it's
right.
a very personal thing, right. And what you're trying to protect your child from is not what they need protecting from at all.
Right.
Do you think we're really traumatized by them? I mean, we've got a lot of great comments, and we're sort of in some ways jokingly saying, you know, I couldn't turn off the lights for years, which was sort of true. But I mean, is it scarring or is it really a good thing? We need these stories, do you think?
Well, I don't think many people are actually scarred. I mean, I think one of the reasons, you know, people can even talk about this and can laugh about it is because you realize that there are things that scare you in life. And I remember, you know, my fair share of these with movies, some of them more rational than others. But I do think it's just kind of part of whether it's a folktale or whether it's a movie or a novel, you know, you have things that confront you with the unknown, typically, or things that you haven't yet experienced in your life. And that's the scary part. And most people do get past them, mercifully.
Movies that are based on stories, I mean, that's one thing. They're deep, they're complex, they have lots of elements. And then there are these didactic films, right, these training and education films, which apparently traumatized a whole lot of people growing up.
Yes, I saw a film about blasting caps when I was a child. I had no idea what a blasting cap was. I'm sure they were not in my suburban neighborhood. And when I was looking for a clips on YouTube, I honestly could not say whether this was the film I saw as a child because my eyes were squeezed shut and my hands were over my ears. But I did recognize the first scene before I closed my eyes.
You don't even have to hold them to get hurt. They're like a hand grenade. I'll bet it scares the daylights out of Kathy.
One of them can cripple or blind you for life. Dangerous when boys and girls touch them. Mike put an eye out. Mike put an eye out. Mike put an eye out. They're like a hand grenade. Might even kill you. Might even kill you.
So you stayed away from blasting caps, I'm guessing. After that, you didn't
you? I was actually really glad to watch the film because they showed you what a blasting cap was, and I didn't know because my eyes were closed. So now I know if I find one not to touch it.
Well, and, you know, for so many of us, when we were growing up, you know, the projector would come out in the classroom, 16 millimeter would come on, and we would learn, you know, about things. And there's a whole genre of scare films, whether it was drugs or drinking or car crashes, sexually transmitted diseases, that the film were meant to scare you, and this is obviously one that was.
Was very effective.
Right, that in this case was very effective. To this day, no blasting caps have passed your threshold, but there are many, many other classroom films that were not meant to scare people, but that still scared people, and there's we have a local national treasure here, Skip Elsheimer of the AV Geeks Educational Film Archive, and he has digitized a bunch of these films that stream on his website, and one of the ones that he streamed is actually one that one of our listeners said was a film that really freaked her out as a kid. And it's called Shopping Bag Lady. And this is a 70s film. And this listener talked about the fact that she saw it in fifth grade in the 1970s. And she was depressed for weeks afterwards.
Hey, Em, this is that weirdo shopping bag lady. Remember the one that was yelling on the street the other day?
What a dirty old freak.
Hey, watch this. Da 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 da.
Picking on an old woman? Get out of here. I'm gonna call the cops.
Hey, Creepo, you're weirder than science fiction.
Well, so yeah, I mean, this is a film about this very grandmotherly woman who's homeless, and the film is obviously trying to teach empathy. It's these three young girls who are being very, very nasty about this this homeless woman, and then one of them ends up beginning to feel some empathy for her, and I think that's part of what this listener who responded to this, I mean, she says in her message that she was telling her mom about the story and just couldn't stop crying because it was so upsetting to her to see this kind of cruel. And so there is this whole other traumatic aspect where this was not meant to, right. You know, make you cry for days. But maybe, you know, maybe it's good that it did because it teaches you how to be more feeling.
Well, they are still making films like this because in the North Carolina public school, at least when my daughter went to school, they had the DARE program, which was part of the Nancy Reagan Just Say No. And she came home one day and she said, I saw this movie where a football player went to a party after the game and he smoked one joint and drank one beer and he died. And she said, and I'm not going back. And I said, that's fine. I'll write you a note. This is ridiculous. You know, remembering my own blast, you're a DARE dropout. You don't get a T-shirt. I can live with that.
You got plenty of T-shirts. Well, that's the other thing. And I don't know how this really happened. But, of course, you know, I was born in the days of those and coming up in those days of fallout shelters when we were warned, you know, how to duck and cover and put our heads between our legs and where to run and what to
but
look at.
But nobody mentioned those duck and cover films at all when that's I asked, which I thought was really interesting because there was no,
scarier
topic.
Well, but those were also meant to make you feel like, well, all you have to do is duck and cover. Right. Everything's going to be okay. I mean, it was the lie that was supposed to make you feel like it was going to be okay if we were, you know, attacked.
Well, and that was part of it. I think I don't know if it was just me and my friends, but those movies to us were so comical that all we could do is laugh about them. And even the, you know, the one joint and one beer, it's like we all knew that wasn't true by third grade, you know. So I mean, I'm saying that in some ways, and I'm wondering if our laughing, you know, through those films, it was us kind of whistling past the graveyard,
right?
Or if actually they were so poorly done that they were just, you know, nobody took them seriously.
I think it's a combination because some of them are truly, you know, ridiculous and they're very hard to take serious. And some of them are truly scary. So I think it really depended upon which ones you were seeing.
There is haunting imagery as well. I mean, a film for me, 13 Ghosts, I couldn't turn the lights off for a while. But the film that affected me the most and badly was The Deer Hunter.
Mm,
I mean, I just left that in a kind of morbid depression And no other film had ever had that effect on me, where my emotions were just repressed for weeks.
There's so much psychological damage in that film. And so there's, you know, it's not that externalized horror that you get in some of the other films that listeners and we are talking about. But I think it's the idea of how, you know, mentally messed up you can get by the world.
Yeah, and that was I mean, I guess it was so realistic in some ways. And Hitchcock didn't come up as much as I thought it would. I mean, you would think a film like
Psycho has affects people's behavior, because there is no woman that would take a shower with the door of her apartment unlocked. I mean, nobody would do that. I mean, that was – so it was an instructional film in that way.
Because
the terror was so real that it changed behavior.
Yeah, but also Hitchcock films, I mean, they have these moments of, you know, horror, such as the shower scene in Psycho or some of the bird attacks in The Birds, which actually was mentioned by a couple of listeners. But they also have humor and they have romance. I mean, they are all these other things. So they're not just, you know, strictly horror films. And so sometimes I think those moments, you know, get kind of bundled in with all of these other emotions.
Yeah, and it depends on how old you are. I mean, I would think that it would affect a young mind deeply. It was on, and I can remember my daughter might have been 6 or 7 years old, and I was watching it, and she suddenly comes in the house from being outside, and we're getting near the shower scene, right? And so I'm trying to distract her, but you remember the music,
right?
The music, bang, bang, bang. That's the thing. That's the main, and I'm talking to her, and we're playing, because I can't get to the TV in time. And I didn't want to just turn it off, because she was that shrewd. She would say, what was that? So I didn't want to draw attention to it. Now he's dragging the body out in the shower curtain, right? And I think it's safe now to look, because no bad stuff is happening. And I said, gosh, I wonder what he's doing, Mary. And she said, well, I don't know. He's taking that thing. And I said, I wonder where he's taking that thing. And she said, well, he's probably going to find out where all that music is coming from. Really.
That's a good one.
It affects people in different ways.
It does.
They see it in different ways. But so we're moving on now. This, your pick, Marcia, the one that terrified you.
Okay, so I'm 9 years old. I'm growing up in Southern California. My grandmother's visiting from Ohio. And my mom says, let's go to the movies. So she takes us to The Elephant Man, which is this David Lynch film. So I'm nine. And this film absolutely completely traumatized me, to the point that as a film studies professor, here I am in 2014, I have not rewatched this film.
Wow. You should tell us a little bit more about that film.
Okay, so, well, I mean, you're asking the wrong person. Maybe someone has seen it. I mean, I've watched clips from it. It's this gorgeous black and white film, but it's about this physically deformed individual who is brutalized, treated like an animal. I mean, I think it won Academy Awards. I mean, it's David Lynch. I'm sure it's photographed beautifully, the little bits that I've seen. But what I remember is, as a kid, sobbing halfway through, and my grandmother taking me out to sit in the lobby while I sobbed, was that it was just so inhumane the way that this person was being treated. And the clip that I was brave enough to find to show is kind of the epitome of this moment.
I am not an elephant! I am not an animal! I am a human being!
But, you know, one of these days I will sit down and watch this film, because it's completely irrational to have an experience from when you were nine, especially when you do this for a living. But, you know, a lot of listeners talked about the fact that the films that traumatized them, they had either not seen again, or it took them 20 or 30 years. And they're the ones that have those serious kinds of reactions where, you know, one listener mentioned The Earthling, which, you know, I've actually not seen, but it's apparently involves some kind of, you know, trauma in a forest or something like that. And, you know, the things that tap into your fears, whether they're that it's going to happen to you or that something awful can happen to someone in the world the way it does in The Elephant Man, those are harder things, I think, to just kind of say, like, oh, it's not a big deal. You know, I'm in my 40s now. I can see this.
Well, The Elephant Man is coming to Broadway with Bradley Cooper.
Oh, you are kidding me.
So I think maybe you can go see that. It won't be quite as scary.
Ooh, I don't know. It could be.
What about revisiting these films? Because I haven't seen 13 Ghosts, but then again, I'd have to have – I lost the glasses, so I can't really see it in 3D anymore.
Right.
Although you should bring it to the museum.
Yes, that would be fantastic. Well, and that's the same thing with my scary movie. I mean, I haven't seen the whole thing again either. So.
Really? You haven't gone back to it. Well, we'll talk about that. And again, age is a factor, I think, in large
part. And I think a lot of what traumatized people is, you know, if they saw a film – at an age they probably shouldn't have seen that film. So for me, I was 9. I mean, if I had been 16, I probably would have been upset, but I would have had a few more years to kind of figure process it, to kind of think about it. Whatever your sensitivity is, I think if you come to these films, you know, at a time where it's not age appropriate, whether it's an explicit horror film or something documenting, something that's just unpleasant, that I think is where the more kind of serious, like, I don't want to see that again comes from.
It'd be interesting to know whether you could do any kind of psychological categorizations based on, like, if I see something that's utterly preposterous but gory, for instance,
right,
it's just not going to bother me.
Yeah.
But anything that's really kind of possible and freaky psychologically,
right,
the Deer Hunter, for instance, just anybody passing into that level of pathological despair.
Fear is a very personal thing. What scares one person does not scare another person.
I mean, I even remember, this is such a ludicrous thing, but seeing E.T. as a kid, which would have come out at a similar time. And I remember, I felt so bad for this little creature. And I remember having these senses of fear that I would encounter a kind of creature and not be able to protect it. It's not rational.
And that scene where the government comes in is so terrifying.
Terrifying.
That could never happen.
No, not here.
You're scaring me. Talking to Marcia Gordon, film studies professor at NC State, Laura Boys, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. More on scary movies just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the movies that terrorized you as a child, young adult, or adult. Marcia Gordon, professor of film studies at North Carolina State. Laura Boys, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. We got lots of calls and tweets about this show, which seems almost everyone out there saw something in their childhood that stuck with them. When we put out this, because we're asking every week, or every month, you talk about films you're interested in. But, man, we talked about scary things. We got lots. Some of the titles came up over and over again, and one of them, of course, is The Exorcist.
My name is Wilton Barnhart. I live in Raleigh, North Carolina. When I was about, I think, 12 years old, my friend and I snuck into The Exorcist. It wasn't so much in the theater. It was after you got home. It was after you were up in your bedroom and the house started creaking and the wind started blowing. And then you started worrying about whether or not you were a candidate for being demonically possessed.
You know what she did?
I think I was not alone. There were articles in Time magazine and other things about how people were having psychological breakdowns and kids were having to go to counseling, and you shouldn't see it if you were too young. But I think if you are in your late 50s, early 60s, The Exorcist was probably the most terrifying film you ever saw.
I mean, this is over and over and over again. People brought up The Exorcist. And I mean, even listening to that clip, that was such brilliant sound design. My gosh, with those voices coming out of Linda Blair's mouth and all those creepy sounds and
the pea soup vomit. Was that a vomiting scene?
Yeah.
Projectile vomiting.
Exactly. And those are like those are the window dressing of this kind of deeper terror of being possessed. And that film created such a complete universe of horror and the sense of not being able to control what was going on. And I mean, I can really, I did not see it when I was, you know, I didn't see it until I was probably in college. So I had a very different experience, but I could certainly see how that's a film. If you saw it when you were, you know, 10 to 13, that could really stick with you.
And this is another film I've never gone back to see again, because my audience experience, I think I saw it the first week it came out. It may even have been in 70 millimeter, you know, a very widescreen format.
Cool.
And I was in a theater where everyone was so terrified. I've never been in a place where strangers would clutch at you out of fear because of what was going on in the screen.
Were people screaming? Or
Oh, my God, yes. Screaming, clutching, hiding their eyes, popcorn everywhere. it was just such an intense, terrifying experience to be in the audience. And this is also part of a cycle of films where people felt they were losing control of their children. And this is, of course, the most extreme example of how your child is not going to listen to what you say anymore.
Yeah, and we should talk about that. I mean, the idea that when it comes to horror, and not all the films that terrorize people were actually horror films in this way.
Right.
But those films do reflect the anxieties of the time. And certainly that was a big one then, and whether or not we were in control even of ourselves and our own emotions, or whether something demonic could possibly be rooted in us.
Yeah. And I mean, in a weird way, I mean, you could even argue that something like Willy Wonka, there's something kindred there with The Exorcist and just thinking about childhood.
I see a YouTube mashup coming on.
Not by me.
Well, you mentioned something else, though, the communal experience, the idea of being in a theater where people are watching this, then you leave the theater and you're in an office where everybody's talking about it. But also there was a lot of news reporting, right? Because there was the house in Georgetown, right? There was the walk-up apartment where the priest had been. So there was a kind of a real-life story that you could attach. So from a PR standpoint, it's a gold mine, which I'm sure they had in mind. But how much does all of that play into this, the kind of the press that it gets, the public reception of a film like
this? And you know, it kind of makes me nostalgic for the days of everybody going to the movies and having these communal experiences. I mean, certainly the 70s and the 80s and these blockbuster films where people are lining up around the block. I mean, nobody does that anymore because you can buy tickets online and you know you're going to get into the theater. But, you know, to have a bunch of people come into a theater, you know, ready to have this experience of being terrified.
Unironically.
Exactly.
Really scared.
That's part of the fun of horror, right? Is that you go into it knowing you're going to be scared, and yet you go anyway.
But nobody knew how scared they were going to be by
with the Exorcist
film. Right.
And that's the other, I mean, I guess in horror, the special effects, there's kind of an arms race to kind of get the next cool thing. And once that becomes, you know, not so cool anymore, it's kitsch. Jaws, of course, in the vanguard in a lot of things. And I think here's where we talked about sound a couple of times. But for me, Jaws sound played an important part in that. Hang on.
My name is Thorin Alexander. I've been in Chapel Hill, North Carolina for the last year. I saw Jaws at a relatively young age, and it pretty much terrified me. I don't think I was able to go into water for the next, I don't know, maybe even year without worrying that I was going to be eaten by a shark. It didn't matter if I was in the bathtub or a pool. It didn't matter. It just awful.
Yes, so many people did not want to swim after seeing this film. I mean, this created a real sense of terror for something that's highly implausible. This is a film that I have taught on a number of occasions in introduction to film classes. And one of the best things to do is actually to play these scenes with no sound, because they are not scary. You do not see scary things. In that particular scene that we just heard, I mean, you see a woman, her body is above water. She gets pulled down a couple times. It is the sound that is so brilliantly done, like Psycho and inspired by Psycho, you know, its predecessor. So that really does come across when you listen to it on the radio.
And also the thing about Jaws is it's not necessarily the shark that is believable, but the actors who are telling you about the shark, that that is the power of the film. I mean, if, when you read about how it was made, they had so many technical problems with the shark, and you can be kind of a cynic about it. But then when Robert Shaw starts his monologue, it's like, you don't think that's a mechanical shark anymore.
Right.
This is like real.
You know, another recurrent listener comment with regard to this film, and I think maybe with regard to The Exorcist, was, why did my parents let me go see this film? Which is interesting because it brings up that idea of age appropriateness. And I kind of like the idea of people looking back on their parents and blaming them for letting them go to see these movies that, of course, they were, I'm sure, were beating down the door to go see. But the idea that, you know, that you're not going to be prepared to deal with this kind of material. Obviously that's a recurrent theme.
And again, you never know what it is that's going to scare who.
Absolutely.
So your brother's sitting next to you laughing and you're under the seat because it's terrifying. Yeah, the sound was brilliantly done. I mean, not only is it music, but there are these bass riffs and these high riffs and splashes. And without that, it's not the least bit scary. But a film like that, when people tell you they didn't, I mean, I couldn't go to bed with the lights off.
Right.
You don't go swimming. There are people who didn't go to the bathtub, right?
Right.
I mean, but this is the art of storytelling. I mean, stories are designed, if you're passing on a culture, to warn people about things they need to be warned about and, you know, explain, anticipate things.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly think, like, you know, a comparison between, say, The Exorcist and Jaws. I mean, I don't think, well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't think many people saw The Exorcist and went, I'm not going to do this, right? I mean, it's not.
Right. Yeah,
but,
I think that's
but,
true.
But Jaws, Psycho, I mean, those give you things that you're like, oh, I'm not going to put myself in that situation. And those may be the ones that kind of stick with you in a different way that actually affects the way you live your life.
Mm-hmm. Here's another film that came up often, and we'll listen to it now.
My name is Shelley Etheridge, and I live in Durham, North Carolina. And the movie that traumatized me is The Shining.
Little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
Now that is a scary film. This is Stanley Kubrick, and that's Jack Nicholson trying to break into this bathroom where his wife, Shelley Duvall, is trying to get out this teeny tiny window, and she's trying to squeeze through it, and he's, you know, trying to break through the door. And it is, I mean, this is just one instance of terror in a very, very long and somewhat abusive film about someone who's gone off the rails.
And actually, the part that I find the scariest in that film is where she discovers that on his typewriter, he's just been typing, "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy," over and over. To me, that is a bigger scare than an axe, that the person that you're living with is so unhinged and you really didn't know how bad it was.
Yeah, I mean, there are very few films in which you see this kind of progression to this kind of dementia and pathology the way that you do in The Shining. And one of our listeners, actually made a comment that I thought was absolutely fascinating. She talked about the fact that she looks back at that film now and realizes that part of the horror for her watching that film had to do with growing up with an alcoholic father and seeing in Jack Nicholson's character, as he becomes more and more irrational and demented and trying to do harm to this family, echoes of what she experienced at home. And so I don't think we can underestimate how much
what you bring to the horror.
What you bring to the horror, and how, you know, even if it's, you know, a much more extreme version, or even if it's abstracted, or even if it's anthropomorphized, that things that are depicted in these films that stick with us and that scared us and that still scare us often resonate with what has happened in our own lives.
So, Laura, now, we have not gotten to your film, and you should tell us.
My film is what seems like a straight-up haunted house kind of movie, but It involves a character played by Julie Harris, who is very unstable and vulnerable, and the evil forces in the house affect her in a very, very personal way. And there are not these – I mean, there's no Jack Nicholson with an axe in this movie. It is rattling doorknobs and overheard voices and your own internal fear. And one thing that's interesting about this clip that you're going to play is how dreamlike it is, and so that it really seems to key into your own dreams.
The film is The Haunting.
This is monstrous. This is cruel. It is hurting a child, and I will not let anyone, anything hurt a child. I will not endure this. Things to scare me, well, it has, and poor Theo, too. Honestly, it feels like she's breaking my hand. I will take a lot from this filthy house for his sake, but I will not go along with hurting a child. No, I will not. I will get my mouth to open right now, and I will yell, I will yell, I will yell. Stop it!
What? What? No, what?
Okay, so I have not seen that film, but I'm listening to this clip with someone who doesn't know anything about this film, and I'm thinking, is this about child abuse? I mean, the way that it's being discussed.
It is to a certain extent because she is a person who is trapped with an overbearing mother, and this haunted house is like a vacation for her, which turns out to be not so much of a vacation, but to get away from her mother. So she is, in fact, the abused child, and she's really empathizing with a child who has died previously in this house.
So this is about a very real thing.
Right.
Yeah, right. And it's one of those Barrel of Monkeys stories where you're never quite sure whether you've got the real picture yet or whether we're going to find out that this is a story within a story and kind of is it all a dream? Mm-hmm. Is that part of what's going on here? Is that, trying to figure out who's the rational one here?
Right. And but for me, just the idea that you could always be hearing a voice off in the distance that is calling you to do harm to yourself or others is, I mean, if I'm someplace sleeping in a strange house, I always think I hear those voices because of this movie.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, uh-oh, exactly. Uh-oh.
Well, but, you know, I think the ones that do have that psychological component where you're possessed or you're willed to be and to do these certain acts, I mean, those are super scary because, you know, the mind,
who is in control of what you do? Are you in control of your own actions or is someone else the boss of you?
And the movies that perform those extreme versions of what can happen when you are not in control of your mind, I think those are the ones that often end up sticking with us in these ways that we always wonder, you know, are we going to be like Jack Nicholson? Are we going to be like Linda Blair
in
The
Exorcist?
Or
are we going to be like our parents or our grandparents?
Right. Right.
I mean, in that way, the dead always have control over you because it's part of your family, part of your genetics.
Right.
And the best ones, I think, are the ones that we're never really sure whether they're in control or not. So where the audience is really left guessing. We're not omniscient as audience members.
Right. I agree.
Well, and the ones that leave open the possibility that this is kind of an ongoing story. I mean, you'll notice that a lot of these films, the ones that come, you know, in the specific horror genre, it's not just to leave way for a sequel, but it's also to give you this sense of being unsettled at the end that whatever this evil or, you know, unbalancing spirit is, it's still out there. It's not a solve. The door is not shut.
Always a pleasure to be terrified by you, Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State, Laura Boies, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next month, we've got a lot of fun. Marcia and Laura are going to be back. We're going to look at literary adaptations in film. So what is your favorite or least favorite literary adaptation. We're talking about the movies. You can tweet us. You can also send us an email, sot@wnc.org. And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Mataferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley's the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.